Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
The House prepares to fast-track a ban or forced sale of video-sharing app TikTok. Plus, we look at Iran's strategy behind Saturday's attack on Israel.
There was a sense that Israel had the upper hand and the Iranians had to turn the table, and they did so dramatically. The attack itself was not very militarily successful, but it was a break with its previous approach to this conflict.
And the Biden administration reimposes sanctions on Venezuela's oil industry. It's Thursday, April 18th. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. We are exclusively reporting that for years, Amazon employees have been using a third-party seller to secretly gather intel about the tech giant's biggest competitors. The operation is called Big River Services International and sells around $1 million a year of consumer goods through online marketplaces, including eBay, Walmart, and Shopify, as a way to keep tabs on things like pricing and logistics of those competitors. Dana Mattioli covers Amazon for The Journal and told our Tech News Briefing podcast that the project was launched back in 2015 under the code name Project Curiosity.
So employees on Project Curiosity team sort of had this double life. They internally would speak to other employees with an Amazon email address. They wouldn't mention the true nature of the work they were doing. But behind the scenes, they had completely different email systems that they used to communicate with rivals and partners on other sites. They had this whole front where they were posing as these sellers on these other sites.
Dana also reviewed emails that show lawyers for Amazon remind people working on Project Curiosity not to mention the connection to Amazon and Big River Services in calls and meetings with rivals.
Some of these team members even went to eBay's seller conference in Las Vegas as Big River Services employees without identifying that Amazon was their employer to get information.
An Amazon spokeswoman said so-called benchmarking is a common practice in business and that the company believes its rivals also carry out research on Amazon. And for more on Dana's investigation into Amazon's practices, check out today's episode of Tech News Briefing wherever you get your podcasts. In Washington, House Republicans have revised their bid to ban or force the sale of TikTok in the U.S. The latest proposal extends the sale period to about 9 months with a possible 3-month extension and would tie the crackdown on the Chinese-controlled app to a $95 billion aid package for both Ukraine and Israel, as well as humanitarian efforts in Gaza that's being voted on this week, which could fast-track the bipartisan effort to become law. Even before last weekend's Iranian attack on Israel, the country had shifted away from a period of accommodation with the West. However, its embrace of direct confrontation nevertheless marked a dramatic illustration of the strategic shifts underway within Iran after spending years building diplomatic ties with America's rivals. And Journal Middle East correspondent Jared Malson reports that while Tehran may now be able to call on more friends in foreign capitals, its decision to step out of the shadows and fight with Israel in the open marks a major gamble. Jared, how significant is it to see Iran, as you say, stepping out from the shadows here like this? And tell us from your reporting what we know about how this decision actually came about.
This is a huge shift in Iran's MO in terms of its war against both Israel and the U.S. For decades, its approach in the Middle East has been to build up this network of proxy groups, militias around the region. That includes Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in the Palestinian territories, Iraqi and Syrian militias, and the Houthi rebels in Yemen. And the purpose of cultivating those relationships, which it did through the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, was to keep the conflict at arm's length, to have plausible deniability, and to limit its own exposure to attack from either the US or Israel. And it's discarded that playbook by launching a direct attack on Israel with both missiles and drones, more than 300 of them. And it's doing that at enormous risk to itself. Why that decision came about, the Iranian regime and the Iranian government are notoriously very opaque. But what we understand is that factions within the government who favor more of a direct confrontation got the upper hand here. There was also some pressure from within this network of allied militias and countries in the region to act. There was a sense that, as one person put it to me, that Israel had the upper hand and the Iranians had to turn the table. And they did so dramatically, trying to seize the initiative. The attack itself was not very militarily successful, but it was a break with its previous approach to this conflict.
Jared, do the ties that Iran has been forging lately with Moscow and Beijing fit at all into its calculus now?
Iran's calculations are that they see themselves as having more room for maneuver now because of their deepening relationships with both Russia and China. Iran is no longer just a client state of Russia. They are actually supplying Russia in their war in Ukraine. They're building a drone factory that's building these Shahed 136 drones that the Russians are launching waves upon waves of them into Ukraine. Those are the same drones that Iran used to attack Israel the other night. And there's a sense that because of this axis of revisionist powers, that they have room to maneuver. They have support, they have allies, that they may not be fully integrated into the international system. But again, they see themselves as being in a struggle to kind of overcome U.S. and Western dominance of the Middle East and the world. And those alliances are a central part of that.
Jared, separately from your reporting, we spoke to Bilal Saab, who is a military analyst and an associate fellow at the London think tank Chatham House, specifically on the topic of what Tehran now knows about its adversaries and the state of their deterrence systems, which at least on Saturday included contributions from Jordan. Let's play a clip.
This was a test the Israelis, in addition to their allies, I would say passed with flying colors. I don't want to start talking about an Arab Israeli, American, NATO. At the end of the day, you got to understand the local and security interests of the Jordanians are always going to come at the forefront. But certainly what we witnessed was enhanced security cooperation that, frankly, is historic. The fact that they all converged and they essentially achieved the same outcome is very much good news for Israel and its friends, and certainly something that the Iranians did not want to see and would have to account for that should there be another attack.
Jared, it sounds like Iran has taken a gamble here. And from what Bilal was saying there, they may have opened up a bit of a Pandora's box from a security standpoint.
That's right. By launching this attack, Iran was taking an enormous gamble because it's now open to retaliation from Israel. The United States has asked Israel not to launch a retaliation, but there's obviously no guarantee that the Israeli government is going to heed that advice. And that's a huge risk for Iran. And it seems to be a risk that they're willing to accept in spite of the fact that they are less militarily capable than Israel, nor do they have the kind of international support that Israel has in terms of having Western and regional countries that would step in and help them in the event of an attack. But what they're saying to us essentially is that these are risks that they're willing to accept in order to turn the tables on the Israelis and take a step that they see as restoring the balance of deterrence between the two.
I've been speaking to Wall Street Journal Middle East correspondent Jared Malson. Jared, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Coming up, the U.S. reimposes sanctions on Venezuela's oil industry and how slumping car demand and efforts to unionize factories are adding to pressure on the automobile sector. We've got those stories and more after the break.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
In a move telegraphed earlier this week, the Biden administration has reimposed sanctions on Venezuela's oil industry after the State Department said that Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro had failed to meet earlier commitments that would lead to fair and competitive elections. Commodities reporter Joe Wallace says that when U.S. sanctions were originally eased 6 months ago, a number of companies had started to dip their toes back into Venezuela.
Those companies will now have to apply for licenses from the Treasury Department if they want to remain in the country. And without such licenses, they'll have to wind up operations by the end of May. Chevron and a few other companies that had licenses dating back to 2022 will not need new ones and can continue to carry on with operations in ventures with the state Venezuelan oil company. And this nuanced approach reflects some of the difficulty that the U.S. faces in trying both to hold Maduro accountable for what the U.S. sees as his anti-democratic actions, while also not doing anything that could disrupt energy markets and push up gasoline prices ahead of the election.
As of January, the U.S. was importing roughly 150,000 barrels of Venezuelan oil a day, just a fraction of America's 20 million barrels of daily consumption. Apple and NVIDIA's chip supplier Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing has reported an 8.9% jump in profits in the first quarter, following three straight quarters of declines. It comes as TSMC worked through an inventory glut and saw a surge in demand from generative AI. Its CFO also disclosed today that an April 3rd earthquake in Taiwan didn't damage critical tools at its factories, but that the scrapping of some wafers used in semiconductor production would slightly dent gross profit margins this quarter. Car sales in the European Union have seen their biggest drop in 16 months, in line with broader trends pointing to softening global demand in the auto sector. March's 5.2% fall in new car registrations was fueled in part by declines at Stellantis and Volkswagen, which saw sales slip by 13% and 9% respectively. Analysts are expecting a down year for the industry amid high borrowing rates for consumers. And speaking of VW, workers at its factory in Chattanooga, Tennessee, have begun voting on whether to unionize by joining the United Auto Workers. If successful, it would mark the first time that the UAW has been able to unionize a U.S. plant that's owned by a foreign commercial automaker. Autos reporter Mike Colias says the union has a lot of momentum after winning several big contracts last fall with Detroit's three automakers, GM, Ford, and Stellantis.
For decades, the Detroit executives have complained about a labor cost imbalance with the transplant automakers, the Asian brands like Toyota, or German automakers like BMW, Mercedes, who built factories in the U.S. starting 50 plus years ago, mostly in the South. And the Detroit companies, their labor costs are 20, 30, 40% higher than those competitors. And so that's given those foreign brands more leeway in terms of pricing, more profit margin to play with. So if the UAW is successful with VW in Chattanooga, it could gather momentum among workers at a number of other plants. I mean, they're targeting factories with collectively around 150,000 workers in all, roughly the same amount that the UAW now represents at the Detroit 3.
The vote results are due late Friday. And before we go, a heads up, this podcast was updated to remove certain language about Big River Services and Amazon's practices under its Project Curiosity. And that is What's News for Thursday morning. Today's show was produced by Daniel Bach and Kate Bullivant. Our supervising producer is Sandra Kilhoff, and I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. We will be back tonight with a new show. And until then, thanks for listening.